Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Ian Tuttle of National Review, who is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Ian, it's good to have you back with us. And the last time we were together, we were talking about the stunning resignation of John Boehner, effective October 30th. Now, of course, the scramble is on to replace him. And it looks like Kevin McCarthy, the current House Majority Leader, has the inside track on that at the moment. The first martini, our good martini, is a little bit mixed because there's a lot of frustration on the right among conservatives about the fact that, once again, they've made good arguments as to why Boehner hasn't been as effective as he probably should have been. Yet when the time comes to actually replace him, there doesn't seem to be a consensus conservative option to go up against Kevin McCarthy, although from what we're hearing from most conservatives, I think they have a more positive view of McCarthy than they do of Boehner. The good news, though, is that there seems to be a pretty aggressive fight among conservatives to get a rock-ribbed conservative in as majority leader. Tom Price has gotten the endorsements of both Jeb Hensarling and Paul Ryan. There's now a draft movement underway to get Trey Gowdy. Again, you would have liked some of these things to be in the percolator before we have to figure all these things out in a very, very short period of time. But at least we're getting some names out there, and if some of these strong conservatives are put in a position of authority, things could look a lot different, and conservatives could be a lot happier.
Yeah, that's right. So as McCarthy seems to be the compromise candidate, and like you say, conservatives seem a little bit happier about him than about Boehner, the question is, okay, does the whole leadership structure just sort of move up a rung? McCarthy becomes Speaker, and Scalise moves up, and McMorris Rodgers moves up, and so you just have this sort of general shift with possibly coming in, potentially Gowdy. That's unlikely to happen. At Kathy McMorris Rodgers, who said that she's not going to run for the majority leader position. She's going to stay as chair of the conference. So this also makes things a little bit more difficult for Scalise, the current number three guy, to move into the number two position. There's a lot of good things to say about Tom Price. He's chairman of the budget committee, financial services expert. He's a 90% rating from the NRA, a 90% rating from pro-life groups. He's very, very strong on the vast majority of issues, and especially when it comes to spending, taxes, these sorts of things. He'd be a good, intelligent, well-informed guy to have in leadership to sort of play with the pieces. There's, like you said, a draft movement for Gowdy. He would be certainly a good person in leadership. I don't have any sort of doubts about that. My question is whether he is better left as an investigator, sort of doing the dogged yeoman's work that he's been doing as head of the Special Committee on Benghazi and these sorts of things. I think that's a question Republicans should seek to sort out. It's not automatic that he would be a better fit in a much more political position, which is what leadership is. Overall, you're likely to get McCarthy. Like you said, Hensarling and Bryant both signed on to Price. So there could be a little bit of a shuffle in the leadership, and the way that it's likely to pan out, the center of gravity could move a little bit farther rightward.
Just a couple of follow-up points on what you said. Tom Price, in addition to the areas of expertise that you mentioned, is a former physician, and he has been a lone voice crying in the wilderness for a patient-centered healthcare reform since the time that Obamacare was being debated and ever since. And it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, certainly from the media, which always contends that Republicans don't have a plan. And right. Also even from, quite frankly, his own leadership, it never really got much traction. And so if he were to be the majority leader, he could certainly bring a lot more attention, a lot more light to a meaningful and beefy reform rather than just being against what's currently on the books.
That's a good point.
As far as Scalise, it's interesting. I don't know that you would necessarily qualify his time as whip as a success. He never really seemed to get the pulse on a lot of key votes on the conservatives, and a lot of scheduled votes ended up being scrapped at the last second as a result of suddenly votes not being there that the leadership thought was there. So I don't know if that's a recipe for him having a different job in leadership or disqualifying, but he had kind of a rough road over the last few months as the whip. On to the bad martini now, and both of these bad and crazy martinis deal with President Obama at the UN. The New York Post essentially saying, Ian, and I know that National Review has a big piece up on this as well, that essentially President Obama has more or less surrendered the role of the dominant player on the world stage to Vladimir Putin, and that was clear yesterday at the United Nations, as Putin was very clear about what he wanted to do in defeating ISIS. He's obviously very cozy with Bashar Assad, which no one in the United States is going to embrace, but his plan seems to have more logic than what the president said, which was basically we can fight Assad and ISIS, who are fighting each other at the same time, and somehow both be successful. The New York Post says, if Obama has any realistic Syria plan of his own beyond having Assad magically transitioned out of the country and simultaneously fighting ISIS, he failed to present it during his UN speech or any other time. Instead, he scolded and isolated Putin for using force to annex Crimea and other parts of Ukraine. Then again, imagine if Obama's eloquence were backed up by, say, American-led NATO. Would Putin so easily be able to eat up Ukraine and take over Syria? Not likely. And then even more scathingly, ripping Obama for basically sounding like a 1950s politician and celebrating the United Nations as a place where problems are actually resolved, and talking about where it's no longer basically cool, Ian, to use might to solve problems, but to be on the right side of history at the UN is where it's at.
Yeah, exactly. This is sort of Obama's global mentality, his sort of transnational geopolitical utopia that we saw even when he was campaigning the first time. You know, I'm a citizen of the world, these sorts of things, this idea that all can be resolved by all of us sitting down and having a beer. Of course, it's not true, and Vladimir Putin understands that. The situation in the reality on the ground in Syria has really gone underreported for a while, until I'd say the last 2 weeks or so, when, behold, here Russia has a huge, huge stake in what's going on. Russia has been training thousands and thousands of troops. It's been supplying arms. It's been basically working to save Assad or whatever the next regime might be as a puppet regime for Russia. And of course, the relationship between Syria and Iran, both as Shia nations as compared to the largely Sunni Arab nations like Saudi Arabia and the rest in the Middle East, would ideally sort of consolidate these Shia nations under the Russian umbrella. What that means, of course, is that the surrounding nations' influence is going to be significantly diminished, and everything is going to sort of channel back toward Russia. The article you referenced in National Review was at the current issue on newsstands, and we just released it onto the website today by Hudson Institute scholar Arthur Herman, where he basically argues that what Putin is doing in Syria is effectively what Hitler was doing in Civil War Spain from 1936 to 1939, sort of testing, wargaming a little bit, sort of behind the scenes developing regional hegemony. And I think he makes a fairly persuasive case that Putin is doing this very effectively, and the results are going to be disastrous in the long term. But the simple fact is the Obama administration has no plan to deal with this. They don't want to deal with this. And Arthur makes the case that, in fact, the United States, at least the Obama administration, is a little relieved about this. It sort of takes the pressure off. You see Josh Earnest saying last week that we would welcome Russia to helping us solve this Islamic State problem. Of course you would, because you don't have any plans to deal with it yourself. But of course, Vladimir Putin has no intention to make this a sort of, you know, bilateral and multilateral coalition. He plans to make sure that the door doesn't hit the United States on the way out.
I think that's the way a lot of people are reading it. And certainly the contrast between the two of them is a study that will probably go on for decades, in their style and their aggressiveness and all sorts of other things. But we stay with the president of the United Nations for our crazy martini. This is an issue that got a lot of attention yesterday in the president's speech to the opening of the General Assembly. He was talking about, I believe, how the Iran deal gave Iran an opportunity to become a responsible member of the community of nations. But here's what he actually said.
That path is now available to a nation like Iran, which, as of this moment, continues to deploy violent proxies to advance its interests. These efforts may appear to give Iran leverage in disputes with neighbors, but they fuel sectarian conflict that endangers the entire region and isolates Iran from the promise of trade and commerce. The Iranian people have a proud history and are filled with extraordinary potential. But chanting death to America does not create jobs or make Iran more secure.
Pretty sure job creation is not the number one goal of the mullahs when it comes to trying to destroy Israel and the United States. That might be a slightly higher priority. And it's interesting that he talks about not creating jobs and so forth. They got lots of billions of more dollars thanks to this deal. So he just made a pretty strong argument against what he just did.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a couple of things. One is, I think that this is Obama trying to respond to sort of obliquely to criticisms of the plan, right? That as he's doing this plan, the mullahs are whipping up crowds to chant death to America. And that doesn't look good if you're the head of the United States negotiating with these same leaders. So here's a way to sort of say, oh, isn't this a bad idea? Why are you doing that? Of course, just as you say, he goes into, you know, his professor-in-chief mode and scolds Iran for somehow not knowing what's in its own best interest. But all of this is belied by the fact that you can't come out after a year plus of negotiations with a negotiating partner that calls you the great Satan and say, stop saying these mean things after you've bent over backwards to forge a deal with this group. What Obama has shown to the Iranian leaders over the past year, 18 months, etc., is you can chant whatever you like on the streets of Tehran. The United States wants this deal desperately. I think it's a sop to his critics, another indication that he doesn't understand the regime with which he's been dealing, and just a complete sort of departure from the reality of the situation on the ground in Iran. But again, he's only in for another year and change. So all of these bad things will be left to his successor to deal with, and then he can go and deliver more citizen of the world speeches to the United Nations as a private citizen and ambassador to the world.
It just goes back to the second martini a little bit in the contrast between Putin and Obama, and this certainly isn't a praise of Putin. I think just about everyone on the conservative side should recognize that he's a complete thug and definitely not in anyone we would want to emulate in most ways. But Putin always finds a way, it seems, to negotiate from a position of strength, where Obama, particularly on the Iran deal, where we should obviously have been negotiating from a position of strength since Iran was the one being crippled by the sanctions. In the end, it was the U.S., due to the desperation you mentioned there in your response, that somehow we ended up being the ones desperate for the deal instead of the Iranians.
Exactly. I mean, it all goes back to Obama's vision of a foreign policy, or sort of a place in the world for the United States that doesn't need military might. You know, he wants to speak softly and not carry any sort of stick. And you simply can't do that. And the reason that Putin has been so effective is he has the sort of, there are plenty of problems. His position is relatively weak in Russia to a certain extent, the internal politics of the country, but he understands the Machiavellian nature of geopolitics, at least the way that it can be played. Obama has no sense of that. He has sort of this utopian, idealistic vision of the role he can play and the role the United States should play. And the simple fact is it doesn't accord with reality and you get walked all over. And that's exactly what's happening.
On that cheery note, we'll call time for today. Ian, as always, great to have you here. Talk to you later.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday when Jim Garrity will be back. Join us then for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.